Civil defenders are good lawyers, he said. You'll get a good defense.
They work for the government. The United States of America signs their checks. I don't care what you say, it's an inherent conflict of interest.
Maybe you can get one of the other lawyers in town to take it, Ritchie said. I'm sure it'll be a highly publicized case. Someone will want the recognition.
I need a lawyer, not a glory hound.
Yes, well...
Ritchie laid his hands flat on the table in front of him and pushed himself up.
This is getting more awkward by the moment. I feel bad, Darren. I really do. But I just can't make such a huge commitment without adequate compensation.
Money talks, I said. Right? He nodded.
Right.
And bullshit walks. So take your bullshit and walk. Get the fuck out of my sight. Chapter 22. Back in the cell, I lay on the upper bunk in the semi-darkness. I could hear the constant shouting from the cell block, and the smell of the man lying in the bunk beneath me was almost overwhelming. The guard had called him Hillbilly, and I could hear him breathing steadily. He hadn't moved when I climbed into the bunk. Earlier, I spread the foam roll, wrapped the sheet around it, and covered it with the blanket. It offered little comfort. I could feel the cold steel of the bed frame coming through the foam. When I laid my head back on the pillow, it was the thickness of a towel. There was a dull ache in my stomach, and I realized I hadn't eaten since noon, which was roughly 11 hours earlier. Had I been at home, I would have simply wandered into the kitchen, opened a cupboard or the refrigerator, and picked out something to eat. But there was no kitchen here. No refrigerators. There was only a stainless steel toilet and a sink. I had no desire to use the bathroom, but the thought of the sink made me thirsty. I sat up for a few seconds, then climbed over the side of the bunk to the floor. I bent over the sink and let the tepid water pour into my mouth. I swallowed a bit, realized it tasted metallic, and spit the rest out. I turned back to the bed and noticed that Hillbilly was standing next to the bunk. He was staring at me silently, like a predator in the night. I stared back at him, unsure of what I should do.
You don't drink unless I say you can drink, he growled in a thick southern drawl. You don't shit. You don't piss. You don't eat. You don't do a damned thing unless I say it's okay.
I tried to maintain my stare and an air of toughness while I sized him up. He was an inch, maybe two, taller than me, but I probably outweighed him by 5 or 10 pounds. I looked at his hands and didn't see a weapon. I'd always heard that prisoners challenged each other on a regular basis in order to establish a hierarchy, something very similar to wild dogs in a pack. But this was a surprise. I'd been in the cell for only a couple of hours. Hillbilly and I hadn't said a word to each other.
And what if I tell you to go straight to hell? I said in a voice that wasn't nearly as confident as I'd hoped it would be.
He turned sideways slightly. A fighter's angle.
I'm gonna give you one chance to get on your knees and ask for my forgiveness, Hillbilly said.
I'm not hitting my knees for anybody. He was on me in a split second. He apparently favored boxing because he stayed on his feet and caught me with a left hook that landed close to my chin and nearly knocked me out. I stumbled back against the door and pulled my arms in for cover while he punched me in the face and the ribs. I felt my lower lip split against my teeth, and one of the blows to my ribs sent such a sharp pain through me that I believed for a second I'd been stabbed. As I stood there with my back against the cell door, the thought of this animal beating me unconscious, and the fear of what he might do after I was unconscious, sent a surge of adrenaline rushing through me. My head cleared, and I managed to get my forehead into his chest and bull-rushed him back across the cell. He groaned as his lower back smashed into the steel sink, and I took the opportunity to bash him in the face with my right elbow. His left hand came up and grabbed my cheek, and I could feel his thumb trying to gouge my left eye. I started trying to knee him in the groin, but the angle wasn't right. By that time, he'd slid off the sink, and we were in the far corner of the cell away from the door. I managed to slip behind him and get my arms around his waist. I lifted his feet off the floor and took him down between the bed and the sink. He didn't seem to have much experience with grappling, so I was able to control his legs and upper body while I wormed my way toward getting him into a chokehold. I got my right forearm beneath his chin, wrapped my legs around his waist, grabbed my right wrist with my left hand, and clamped down on him like a boa constrictor. Within 10 seconds, he was out. I rolled off him and stood. I noticed movement and looked at the door. 2 guards were standing outside the cell. They'd apparently been watching the fight.
"Good God almighty, boy," one of them said. "You done whipped Hillbilly."
"That's a first," his buddy said. "Hillbilly's been whipping people on this block for years."
"Let me out of here,"
I yelled as I beat my fist against the plexiglass window.
"Open the door. I need medical attention."
"You look all right to me,"
one of them said. Just then, I felt a hand touch my shoulder and spin me around. I saw a bright flash, and everything went dark. Chapter 23. The guards left us in the cell together. I don't know how long I was unconscious, but I awakened with my head in the corner of the cell and my body twisted at an odd angle. Hillbilly was sitting on his bunk staring at me. I pushed myself up into the corner, slowly stood, and waited for him to come, but he didn't move.
"Show's over,"
he yelled at the guards, and they finally moved away from the cell door and went back down the stairs.
"You ain't bad,"
Hillbilly said after they were gone. He was rubbing his chin where I'd cracked him with my elbow. My jaw felt like it was locked tight. I could feel both of my eyes swelling, and my ribs hurt like hell. "I'm not asking for your permission for anything," I said. "You're not going to bully me." He chuckled, and I could tell it hurt. He was as sore as I. "What?" I said. "What's funny?"
"You talk like a city boy. You educated?"
"I went to college."
"They teach you how to survive in jail?"
"No, that particular subject wasn't in the curriculum."
"You did okay on your first test."
"Yeah?"
"Rule number one is don't be anybody's bitch. You let them, people in here'll eat you alive. They'll take your money, your commissary, your cigarettes, your stamps, anything they can get from you. You have to stand up for yourself. If you have to fight, you fight. If you don't, you're going to get robbed every time you turn around."
"What else?" I said. Richie had been right earlier. I was stuck for at least 6 months, maybe a year, before I even went to trial. I had no control. I knew my trial date would depend on the judge's calendar, the U.S. attorney's schedule, and my lawyer's schedule. Even if I asserted my rights under the Sixth Amendment and demanded a speedy trial, courts had held that 16 months was a reasonable delay on a murder case. I needed to learn as much as I could about how to deal with my present situation.
"Don't show weakness. Don't ever show weakness. Don't trust anybody. That means other inmates, your cellmate, and especially the guards. Don't ask dudes why they're in prison unless you get to know them real good. Don't show emotion. Don't ever stare at anybody. Don't talk bad about another inmate because it's going to get back to them. You can be friendly with other races, but not too friendly. Be loyal to your own race. Don't join a gang. Stay away from drugs and booze. Don't call anybody a punk or bitch unless you're ready to fight to the death. And if you're in a shower with a bunch of dudes, wear boxers."
I felt like I should be taking notes.
"You gay?"
he said.
"No." "That's good. If you're lying, keep it that way. That shit you hear about people being raped in prison all the time ain't true. Inmates will stab you, but they won't rape you. The gays get segregated in most places, but you need to stay away from them. They ain't nothing but drama queens. Big trouble. Did you bring money for a commissary account?"
"They picked me up at a restaurant in Knoxville. It was a surprise, out of the blue. I have maybe $30 in my wallet and a credit card."
"You're going to need basic things like soap and a toothbrush and underwear and socks. You have to buy all that from the commissary, believe me. It ain't cheap. The food in this place is shit, so if you want anything extra to eat, you have to buy snacks from the commissary. You can put up to $500 in your account, but don't ever tell anybody how much you have."
How often do we get out of this cell?
I asked.
The block is maximum security, which means you must have done something pretty damn bad to get yourself put in here. We get out of the cell once a day for 1 hour. That's the only time you can use a phone. The only way to call out is collect, and it's expensive. Nobody can call in, and they won't bring you a message. The guards are punks. Most of them are cruel. They love to pound on dudes. Don't ask them for anything and don't trust them.
I shook my head and let out a deep sigh. 23 hours a day locked up in this cage with Hillbilly? My legs suddenly felt weak. I'm going to get back on the bunk now, I said. Am I going to have to fight you again?
I don't reckon.
I walked over, climbed stiffly onto the steel platform, and rolled onto my back. They charged me with first-degree murder, I said after a few minutes, but I didn't do it. There was no answer. After a couple more minutes, I said, Why are you in here?
You don't know me that good, Hillbilly said. Now shut up, and let me go to sleep.
Chapter 24 I'd been inside the United States District Courthouse in downtown Knoxville plenty of times, but I'd always walked freely through the front door. On this day, I was cuffed and shackled as I was hustled through a sallyport and down a hallway to a holding cell. I'd never cared much for representing criminal defendants in federal court. The judges were all blue bloods who had far too much regard for their own intellects, and their holier-than-thou attitudes seemed to permeate the atmosphere and infect the other people who worked in the building. The United States attorney, the assistant U.S. attorneys, the agents of the FBI and DEA, the U.S. marshals, even the judges' clerks seemed to think that they were a cut above everyone who didn't spend their days serving Uncle Sam. When I walked through the door into the courtroom, I almost gasped. The place was packed. I'd been isolated all weekend, and other than a couple of wise-ass comments from a guard on our block about me being some hot-shot lawyer, I hadn't given much thought to the journalistic possibilities of my situation. But as I looked around, it began to dawn on me. I was a young, white criminal defense lawyer, a local boy with a clean record, a family man. I was accused of first-degree murder. The reporters reminded me of jackals scrounging for carrion. The worst of it, though, was my mother. She was wearing a navy blue business suit, her head held high, standing right behind the defense table. I mouthed, "I love you," to her as I walked across the courtroom. I hadn't heard a word from Katie, which didn't really surprise me. The only way for me to contact her was by phone during my 1 hour out of the cell each day, which was usually closer to 30 minutes. I would have to call collect, and she would have to accept the charges. I was sure she wouldn't, so I didn't even try. To her way of thinking, what had happened to me would be nothing but an advantage for her, since she knew I'd discovered her affair. She wouldn't give a damn about what Sean thought or heard or saw on television. As a matter of fact, I felt fairly certain she had probably gleefully informed him that I'd killed someone, and would most likely never return. But the thing that was weighing on my mind most heavily was who would wind up representing me. I'd thought about different lawyers in town, but nobody really stood out besides Richie, and he was obviously no longer an option. I couldn't afford a heavy hitter from Nashville or Memphis, and paying a low fee and hiring a bad lawyer was probably worse than having no lawyer at all. Mom didn't have the money to hire an expensive lawyer, and even if she did, I wouldn't have wanted her to spend it on me. I'd pretty much decided at that point that I could handle the case myself as long as they appointed me a decent mouthpiece. And Richie had been right about one thing. The federal defenders were generally excellent lawyers. The positions were highly competitive because they paid far better than state public defenders. Most of the federal defenders I'd known had been law geeks, the type who edited their law review in law school and who graduated at the top of the class and went on to clerk for federal judges. A marshal led me to the defense table. I looked at Ben Clancy, pink-cheeked and puffy, who was sitting at the prosecution table like a toad on a rock, acting as though he wasn't aware I was in the room. He was wearing a shiny gray suit with red kerchief. The kerchief had the same paisley design as the red bandana I'd used to help defeat him. The judge was already sitting on the bench. I looked up at him and felt an even deeper wave of anxiety pass over me. His name was Donnie Gear, a tall, lean, 60-year-old egomaniac who wore wire-framed glasses and still dyed his hair red. I'd done battle with Gear several times, and in his courtroom, I'd always lost. One does not beat a federal judge on his own turf. I'd managed to get him reversed twice in the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, however, both times on Fourth Amendment issues. He should have respected me, but instead, he loathed me. Gear looked down at me from his perch on high and said,
"Mr. Street, it genuinely disturbs me to see you standing there."
"I'm not real happy about it either, Judge," I said.
"You're charged with first-degree murder," he said.
"Yes, sir. I understand."
"What have you done about retaining counsel?"
"I spoke to an attorney, but I'm embarrassed to say I'm not going to be able to afford anyone. It's a first-degree murder case. I'm not guilty, and we're going to end up going to trial. The attorney I spoke to asked for a figure I couldn't begin to pay, and given the circumstances, that price seems to be the bottom line for a competent criminal defense lawyer."
"Are you asking the court to appoint a lawyer to represent you free of charge?"
"I don't think I have a choice."
"Forgive me, Your Honor, but that seems hard to believe,"
Ben Clancy said from my right.
"Mr. Street has been practicing law for several years now, and from everything I've heard, he seems to be quite busy, quite successful. As a matter of fact, if I'm not totally misinformed, he recently moved into a $500,000 home, and surely he has financial accounts, investments, things of that nature. The Federal Defender Program is designed to help indigent defendants, people who have no means to hire a lawyer. I don't believe for a second that Mr. Street is indigent."
I might be able to work out some kind of financing arrangement with an attorney if I was going to be able to continue to work, I said to the judge, but I don't see that happening. Does Your Honor intend to set me a reasonable bail?
"He's charged with first-degree murder," Clancy said. "We have a strong case against him. He's a danger to the community."
"I've lived here my entire life," I said. "My family is here. I've never been charged with any kind of crime until this. I'm not a flight risk, Judge. I plan to prove myself innocent and go back to practicing law."
"You're representing yourself right now," Judge Gear said. "That's never a good idea. And the answer to your question is no. I'm not going to set you a bail. Mr. Clancy is right. The indictment charges you with a premeditated murder by ambush. I'm going to ask you to fill out an application for an appointed lawyer. If you meet the criteria, I'll approve the application. If not, I'll expect you to hire a lawyer and have him here the next time you appear in court, which will be a week from today. We'll do a formal arraignment then."
I cringed at the thought of waiting a week to find out who my lawyer was going to be, but there wasn't a damned thing I could do about it. The marshal took me by the arm and led me toward the inmate exit. I looked back over my shoulder at my mom, who was standing there with tears running down her cheeks. Just as we cleared the door, another marshal appeared. He was carrying a sheaf of papers, which he handed to me with a smile.
"Looks like your wife isn't impressed," he said.
I looked down at the papers. Katie had either been preparing, or she had flashed some money at a divorce lawyer over the weekend. Probably money given to her by her parents or her geriatric boyfriend. I read through the papers quickly. A petition for divorce that asked for all of our assets plus full custody of Sean. A temporary injunction barring me from going anywhere near my home, my wife, or my child. And a petition to terminate my parental rights. It was Monday at 10 in the morning. It looked like I was in for a hell of a week. Chapter 25. Grace Alexander, at 30 years old, was the youngest federal defender in the Knoxville office. She scanned through the emails on her phone,
looked up at the clock on her office wall, and drew in a deep breath. She let it out slowly, then started tapping a pen on the top of her desk. 24 hours earlier, Grace had been assigned to represent Darren Street. It was a huge case as far as publicity, and that was exciting, but it was also a first-degree murder, and the stakes were high for her client. She hadn't yet met Street, but she was about to meet his mother. The woman had been calling for days, asking whether the judge had appointed a lawyer for her son. Yesterday, she'd been told yes, and she had asked immediately to speak with Grace. Grace had dealt with mothers of clients in the past. For the most part, she'd found them to be unrealistic excuse-makers, blind to the things their offspring had done, and unwilling to accept that their babies were headed to prison. But this one had seemed reasonable on the phone, so Grace reluctantly agreed when she asked if she could come to Grace's office and talk. Grace stood as the woman walked in. She was attractive, around 50, with brown hair and green eyes.
"Miss Alexander?" the woman said.
Grace could tell immediately that she was expecting someone older. She looked dismayed.
"Yes. I'm Shirley Royston, Darren's mother. It's nice to meet you."
Grace motioned to a chair, and Ms. Royston sat down.
"How can I help you, Ms. Royston?"
Grace said.
"I just wanted to come here and look you in the eye and tell you my son is innocent," Miss Royston said.
It was all Grace could do to keep from rolling her eyes.
"Yes, ma'am,"
she said.
"I was with him all during that week because his wife was too self-absorbed to give a damn about her own child. He didn't kill anyone, Miss Alexander. The problem we're going to have, I believe, is that we don't have... oh, what's the word I'm looking for? When you can prove you were somewhere else when something happened?"
"An alibi?"
"Exactly. We don't have an alibi."
"Of course you don't,"
Grace wanted to say.
"Nobody ever has an alibi when they're guilty."
Instead, she said,
"Why not?"
"From what I understand," Miss Royston said, "Mr. Jordan was shot and killed on Thursday afternoon that week, sometime in the early afternoon. Darren was fishing with his son, Sean, during that time, but I doubt that there's a videotape of it."
"Maybe he stopped and bought gas or something,"
Grace said.
"I'll ask him when I go to talk to him tomorrow."
"So you haven't talked to him yet?"
"No, ma'am. They just told me about the case assignment yesterday afternoon, right before you called. I'm planning to meet with several people today and find out what I can, and then I'll go to Maryville and talk with him tomorrow."
"Would you like for me to fill you in on what happened leading up to the shooting?"
"By all means."
Grace listened as Shirley Royston recounted the unbelievable tale of what had happened to her son that week. She took detailed notes, nodded a lot, and asked a great deal of questions. When Ms. Royston was finished, Grace said,
"Wow, that's quite a story."
"You don't believe me?"
"I didn't say that,"
Grace lied.
"I just said it's quite a story. So, while all of this was going on, someone else apparently shot Jalen Jordan on a trail in Gatlinburg."
"That's right. And we don't have any idea who it was or why he or she did it. We were just relieved to know that Sean was safe."
"And this was after Darren had talked to the FBI?"
"The day after, I believe. Are you going to be able to get Darren out of this?"
"I have no idea, Ms. Royston. It's too early to make any kind of prediction. I have no idea what kind of proof they have, but my experience with the federal government has been that if they indict and arrest someone, they have a pretty strong case, or at least they think they do."
"How well do you know Ben Clancy?"
"Fairly well on a professional level, not at all personally."
"Do you like him?"
"I don't really like to talk about people, Ms. Royston."
"So you don't like him. Please do me a favor and look up the history between Mr. Clancy and my son. There's a case, State of Tennessee versus Tommy Royston, that should tell you everything you need to know. Tommy was my brother, Darren's uncle. Ben Clancy convicted him of murdering his wife when he knew all along my brother didn't do it. Darren hates him."
"Does Darren hate a lot of people?"
"No. Darren is a good person, Miss Alexander. An extremely good person who has worked hard to get where he is. No one has given him a thing. His father was awful. He used to beat him terribly.
He beat both of us terribly, and I think Darren developed some issues because of that. Darren was the one who finally stood up to his father. He was only 13, but one night when Billy, that was Darren's father's name, started in on me, Darren beat him up with a baseball bat and dragged him out of the house. He told him he had to leave, that he was never going to hurt either of us again, and he meant it. I think Darren would have killed him if it had come down to it, but Billy was a drunk and a coward, and he just left and never came back. Darren probably suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder, and he has a bit of a hero complex. I think that's why he got into criminal defense law. That and what happened to my brother.
Beautiful,
Grace thought. My new client beat his father with a baseball bat and has some issues.
I appreciate you helping me understand, Ms. Royston,
Grace said.
But it would probably be best if you didn't say anything about Darren's mental or emotional issues to anyone else.
What? Oh, right, of course. I don't want you to get the wrong impression. I just told you that because... Oh, well, I don't know why I told you, other than I want you to understand why Darren might have overreacted at first to his son being threatened. But he didn't kill anyone. I've never known him to own a rifle, and I don't think he's ever been hunting. And besides... How could Darren have known where Jalen Jordan would be that Thursday? He wasn't spying on him. We were hiding from him.
Grace nodded and looked at the clock on the wall. She had another meeting in 10 minutes.
Ms. Royston, she said, I really appreciate you coming in to talk with me, but I have another... Wait, please. Would you mind telling me just a little bit about yourself? The rest of my son's life is apparently going to be at stake. I'd like to know something about the person who is going to be representing him.
Of course, Grace said, not really wanting to tell the woman anything.
What would you like to know?
I'm not sure. How old are you, for starters?
I'm 30.
And how long have you been out of law school? 5 years or so?
Right, 5 years. I graduated from the law school at Vanderbilt University, and then I clerked for Judge Donald Kincaid in Memphis for 2 years. I applied for the Federal Defender Program and was lucky enough to get a job in Knoxville. I've been here for 3 years.
Grace saw Ms. Royston's eyes pass over her left hand, which did not display any rings.
Do your parents live here?
Grace smiled and shook her head.
No, ma'am. My parents are in San Diego. My father is a colonel in the Marine Corps, a career officer. My mother teaches journalism at San Diego State University. So, you've traveled a lot. We actually spent a lot of time in San Diego because that's where my dad's unit is headquartered. He was gone a lot, but it wasn't all that bad.
Are you close to your parents?
Grace thought about her answer for a second and then said,
Why is that important, Ms. Royston?
I'm sorry. I shouldn't pry. It's just that Darren and I are very close. We always have been, mostly because of what we went through with his father, I'm sure. And the thought of him sitting in a jail or a prison? The thought of him being convicted of a murder?
Miss Royston's voice trailed off, and tears began to stream down her face.
Please, Miss Alexander, she said. Please don't let Ben Clancy destroy my son. I'm terrified for Darren because I know what Clancy is capable of.
I'll do what I can, Miss Royston,
Grace said, growing more uncomfortable by the second as this stranger wept in front of her. She reached into a desk drawer, brought out a box of tissues, and offered it to her client's mother.
But I have to warn you, it isn't easy to win against the United States government in federal court.
Ms. Royston stood, wiping her eyes with tissue.
I'll go now, she said. I'm sure you're very busy. Just please, please remember that Darren is innocent. He's worth fighting for.
Grace watched her turn and walk out the door. When it closed, she said under her breath,
Right. Your son is innocent, and I'm the Easter Bunny.
Chapter 26 On Thursday, the guards showed up at my cell, slapped the cuffs and shackles on me, and led me to the attorney's room. Sitting at the table was a young, pretty in a prudish kind of way, green-eyed blonde, wearing a pink blouse and designer glasses that were perched on a perfect nose. I sat down across from her and didn't say a word.
Are you trying to intimidate me?
she said after a minute or so. Who are you? I said.
I'm your lawyer.
No, you're not. You're a kid.
I'm also your lawyer. My name is Grace Alexander. I'm with the Federal Defender's Office, and I've been assigned to your case.
How old are you? She looked at me like she might spit in my eye.
I'm old enough to have graduated from high school, college, and law school. I'm old enough to have passed the bar and gotten a job in the Federal Defender's Office. I'm old enough to have tried 15 trials to a jury, 2 of which I managed to win. I'm old enough... Excuse me, I said.
Did you just say you're 2 and 13 as a trial lawyer? 2 wins, 13 losses?
Most of them were drug cases where the government was offering 30 years. My clients felt like they might as well go to trial and take a shot with a jury. They were really no worse off having gone to trial and lost, and it gave me some valuable experience.
Wow. Good for you, I said. Tried any murders?
2.
Lose both of them?
Sure did.
Why?
Because my clients were guilty.
She was young, but she was poised, and I'd known criminal defense lawyers who absolutely never tried a case to a jury. They were terrified of juries and resolved every case by plea agreement. This young lady had tried 15 cases, and even though I was giving her a hard time, I was impressed. I can't tell you how comforted I am that you've been assigned to my case.
Yes, well, perhaps you should have saved some money so you could hire a real lawyer.
If I'd known I was going to get charged with first-degree murder, I would have saved every dime I ever earned. Even that probably wouldn't have been enough.
Probably not,
she said. I'm not guilty, you know.
Good for you. It always makes me feel better about representing someone when they come right out and tell me that, even if they aren't telling the truth, and my experience has been that about 99% of them aren't telling the truth.
I'm telling the truth. I didn't kill anyone. She folded her hands on top of the table and held my gaze. Her eyes were flecked with black, extremely pretty.
Judge Gere is going to arraign you formally Monday morning at 9, she said. You can forget bail. I already talked to him and it isn't going to happen. I spoke to both him and Mr. Clancy, and it looks like the soonest we can get the trial done will be 6 months from now. Probably late September.
What do you think of Clancy? I said.
I think he's a snake in the grass. He'd do anything to win a case, and he feels a special sort of loathing for you.
So you know what we're up against?
I know exactly what we're up against. 8 of my 15 trials have been against Ben Clancy.
Have you beaten him?
Not yet. But back to what I was saying. The judge has agreed to have you transfer to Knoxville, so it will be easier for me to talk to you. But the Knox County Sheriff says, since you're charged with first-degree murder, you have to stay on a max block. That means the same drill as here. 23 hours locked down in the cell. I also met with your mother yesterday, so I know basically what happened, although I'm going to need to hear it from you several times.
Why several times? I said.
Because it's such a wild story that if you're lying, you won't be able to keep everything straight.
Fair enough.
I don't want to get into it here today because I don't really trust this place, but if you can figure out a way to get a cell to yourself when they move you downtown, it would help a great deal as far as you and I being able to speak openly. I've never known of the Knox County Sheriff to put listening devices in the attorney's rooms, but from what your mother told me about you and Clancy, we should probably be extra careful.
Fine, I said. Extra careful.
I'll see you soon, she said.
She stood, closed her briefcase, and within a minute, the only thing left was the scent of her perfume. I didn't kill anybody, I said to the walls. I need you to know that. I need you to believe it. I didn't kill Jalen Jordan. The guards came in and led me back to the cell. As soon as they'd unlocked the handcuffs and closed the pie hole, I turned around and looked at Hillbilly. Let me ask you a question, I said. If you wanted to get a cell to yourself, how'd you go about it? Chapter 27. They moved me about 12 hours later. I was asleep in the cell at 4 in the morning when the guards came. They hustled me through the building, back through booking and the sally port, and chained me to a cold steel ring inside a white van. We arrived at the Knox County Jail in downtown Knoxville in less than 45 minutes, where I had to go through the entire booking procedure again. The sadistic bastards even strip-searched me again, made me squat and cough, spread my butt cheeks, and shower in front of them. There was absolutely no reason for them to do it. I'd been removed from a cell and had been supervised every step of the way, but they did it anyway. They gave me a fresh gray and white striped jumpsuit, flip-flops, and the same thin bedding and led me to another maximum security cell block. I was as humiliated as I'd been the first time they made me squat and cough, but this time there was another emotion pushing its way to the front. Anger. I was already tired of being herded and humiliated and treated like an animal, and I was only a few days into it. Just as we were walking up to the cell door, one of the guards, who looked like the rest of the guards, a white, muscle-bound skinhead, said,
"Joe DeBose hired me, dickhead. I can't wait for you to give me an excuse to bust your skull open."
I turned and looked at him, thinking I should probably keep my mouth shut, but the anger was sizzling. Hillbilly's advice was echoing, and I couldn't restrain myself. "DeBose hired you?" I said. "What were your qualifications? Inbred ingrate? Is your mother your cousin? Do you read above a first grade level? Does everybody start in the jail and then move out to patrol? Joe's been dead 2 years and you're still here. You must be a real mover and shaker." He grabbed a handful of my hair, slammed my forehead into the metal cell door, and punched me in the kidney. The blow to my head and the punch took me to one knee, but I managed to get back to my feet. "I'm going to beat this charge," I said through clenched teeth, "and then I'm going to come back here and stomp your ass. I'm sure you'll still be around." He spun me around, pushed me flat against the cell door, and stuck the index finger of his right hand into my forehead just above my nose. The other guard, who had walked with us, had stepped to the side a few steps. I glanced at him, but couldn't read anything on his face.
"You ain't gonna stomp nobody," the DeBose hire hissed. "And you need to remember something. I fucking own you when you're on this block."
The volume of his voice was building slowly. His face was turning pink. The veins in his neck and forehead were bulging. He was putting on a show for all of the inmates on the cell block who were watching and listening.
"This is my block," he yelled. "My fucking block! You disrespect me on my fucking block, and I'm gonna fuck you up! I'm gonna put you in the fucking hospital! You got that, you pansy-ass criminal-loving faggot?"
I thought criminal-loving must be a reference to my career as a defense attorney, and in that moment, it actually amused me. I suppose it was the completely overwhelming nature of everything that had happened over the past few days, the feelings of total helplessness and humiliation, the fear, the confusion, the anger, coupled with his ugly, spitting, yelling, redneck presence in my personal space that caused me to suddenly react without giving any thought to the consequences. I truly didn't care what happened when I headbutted him. I moved my head quickly to the side, which caused his finger to slip off my forehead and caused him to move a bit closer to me, and I slammed my skull into the bridge of his nose as hard as I could. I felt the cartilage in his nose give, saw the shower of blood, and within seconds, the two of them were on me, quickly followed by two more. They beat me savagely. Luckily, I was either knocked out or I passed out from the pain in less than 2 minutes. A week later, after the arraignment, Grace Alexander showed up unexpectedly in the afternoon. I was in an admin, an isolation cell, chained to two thick steel rings sticking up out of the concrete floor when she arrived. I was sitting on the floor, but there was a concrete bench that served as a bed that ran along one wall, and she sat down on it next to me.
"No wonder I had such a hard time getting in here to see you," she said. "I had to practically get a court order. What happened?"
I lifted my head slowly. It hurt to breathe, let alone speak, but I managed to say,
"You told me to get a cell to myself."
"What? What are you talking about? Who did this?"
"A guard did it," I said. "A couple of guards. Maybe three or four. I'm not really sure. But I started it. It was the only way to guarantee a cell to myself. I had to fight the guards."
"Fight the guards?" she said. "You mean physically fight them? You're supposed to be a lawyer. Lawyers fight with principles and words."
"This isn't court," I said. "And I'm an inmate. A prisoner. I'm not a lawyer in here. After you left last week,
when I was still at Blunt County, I went back to my cell and asked my cellmate how I could get a cell to myself. He told me that if I start messing with the guards, they'll put me in a cell by myself so there won't be any witnesses when they come beat the hell out of me. He said I have to fight them and fight hard, but if I chill out after a while, they'll eventually quit beating me. They'll also leave me in a cell by myself. It's a respect thing. I don't really understand it yet, but I'm working on it.
You should be in a hospital, she said. I'm going straight to the sheriff.
No, don't do that. You'll ruin what little I've managed to accomplish so far. These guards won't respect me if you go crying to the sheriff, and I don't need to be in a hospital. They know what they're doing. I'm bruised all over, but there isn't anything life-threatening. None of them want to get caught up in a killing.
So this is how you... How you...
I managed to crack a smile. I did it all for you, my dear. Just so we could be alone. I started to chuckle, but my ribs were bruised so badly I couldn't. I must have cringed because her eyebrows curled into a look of sympathy.
I heard what happened after court your first day, she said, serving you with divorce papers when you walked out of the courtroom. That was really low, even for Clancy. They couldn't have done it without his prior knowledge and approval.
He's capable of much worse.
I wasn't all that familiar with the situation between you and him, she said, so I did some research yesterday. I'm not sure I could have done what you did. It took a lot of courage.
It was almost intoxicating, having her in the cell close to me. She was wearing clothes that were less formal than what she'd been wearing when I met her in Blunt County, and when she came to court. Tight, faded jeans tucked into mid-calf leather boots, a purple blouse, a white scarf tied loosely around her neck. Her hair was down, falling loosely in waves to her shoulders. The glasses still gave her a librarian, prudish kind of look, but she was a pretty prude. Her skin was smooth and unblemished, her fingers long and slim, and she smelled so good, so fresh like a flower, lilac maybe. The combination of the look and the smell represented to me the freedom I'd taken for granted such a short time earlier. Grace Alexander became, in that brief encounter that day, a symbol of hope, and I think I began to love her for it.
Courage, I said as I pulled myself back to the moment. I'm not sure courage is the right word. I was angry more than anything because of what he'd done to my uncle. I was reckless sometimes. It seems to be part of my nature.
You ousted him from the DA's office. The Red Bandana campaign was a stroke of genius.
He beat himself, I said. He didn't take his opponent Morris seriously because he'd become so arrogant. He certainly didn't take me seriously. He regarded me as an insect, something to squash. He still does. Do you know he used to keep a miniature replica of an electric chair on his desk?
Grace shook her head.
Can you imagine that? That's the way he thinks of himself, though. Judge, jury, and executioner. I assume you've been in his new office?
Grace nodded. Sure, plenty of times.
No electric chair?
I haven't seen it.
Then Blackburn must have told him to tone it down. He hasn't changed at all, though. I could see it in his eyes in court. He's going to do anything he can to convict me and send me to prison for the rest of my life.
Speaking of... I got a partial witness list from him this morning.
Yeah? Who's on it?
Your wife, for starters. Your secretary, the victim's mother. A Knoxville cop named Olivia Denton. Another cop named Bob Ridge. An FBI agent named Paul Freeman. A man named James Tipton Jr. A man named Hobart Godsey. Plus the medical examiner and any other experts they might call.
I wonder how they got to James Tipton. I said.
Tipton being on their list wasn't good. I thought he would be a witness for me, that he would come in and tell the jury that I'd tried to hire him, but then I'd called it off. He's the former client, right? The one you went to see?
Right. There's no way he would come to them voluntarily. I was going to ask you to interview him and consider calling him as a witness. I wonder what in the hell he's going to say.
I'll put an investigator on it and find out. She said.
And who is Hobart Godsey?
I don't know, she said. I just got these names. I was hoping you could help me out.
No idea,
I said. There's something else I have found that bothers me, she said.
What's that?
You told me you don't hunt. You don't own a rifle, have fired one only a few times, and you don't ever hunt.
Right. So?
The FBI found a tree stand in your garage when they searched your house. It's on Clancy's discovery list. He's going to introduce it at trial.
What? A tree stand? In my garage? Where in my garage?
Doesn't say exactly. Why would you have a tree stand in your garage?
I don't. I mean, I didn't. There was no tree stand in my garage.
You haven't been in the house all that long, right? Any chance it was left by the former owners?
It's new. We bought it new. I'm telling you, there was no tree stand in my garage. They must have planted it.
Who? The FBI? We're not really going to go down that road, are we?
Whoever is trying to frame me for this murder must have planted it, I said.
Fine. Think about it some more and we'll talk about it again soon. In the meantime, I know a lot of lawyers don't like to do this, but I'd like to hear the truth from you, Darren. Tell me everything. Exactly the way you remember it.
I leaned back against the concrete, took as deep a breath as I could without cringing, and started talking. I told her the whole story, from the meeting with Jordan to being arrested at the restaurant. When I was finished, she put her hands on her knees, dropped her chin, and started staring at her boots.
As I see it then, she said, our defense will be, and this is the macro version, that Jalen Jordan threatened to kill your son during a conversation you and he had at your office. He then went to your son's school and waited until your mother picked your son up, and then he followed them to your mother's house. You were already alarmed, but when you found out he had followed your mother and Sean to your mother's home, you became even more terrified. In a moment of desperation, you went to James Tipton's house, a former client whom you knew to have violent tendencies, and you gave him $50,000 to kill Jordan. The next morning, however, you went back and called the whole thing off because, as I understand it, your mother told you to, and you came to your senses. After that, you hid out for a couple of days, and by complete coincidence, somebody else killed Jordan. Is that right?
That's pretty much it, I said quietly.
And you also let Tipton keep the $50,000.
I did.
I shook my head and took a slow, deep breath. For the millionth time, I asked myself, what were you thinking? How could you possibly have wrapped yourself up in this? The facts were an absolute nightmare for any lawyer, any defendant. If I'd been representing someone who told me a similar story, I'd have started talking to him or her about making the best deal possible and entering a plea.
Do you realize how difficult this is going to be, Darren?
I know it looks bad, but I'm innocent. I didn't do it. That's a fact. The most important fact.
Do you have any idea who killed Jalen Jordan?
I shook my head. I don't. I really don't.
Then we're in for a war, she said. And to be honest, if I was betting, my money would be on Ben Clancy. But I took it upon myself to put a bug in the ear of a friend of mine at the Knoxville News Sentinel.
She reached into her briefcase, pulled out a section of the newspaper, and held it up for me to see. A banner headline on the front page said, "Did accused lawyer shoot serial child killer?"
They're going absolutely crazy over this,
Grace said as I skimmed through the story. It speculated that Jalen Jordan was the only suspect in the murders of the two boys and that the FBI had evidence in its possession that was taken from Jalen's van and matched the boy's DNA.
Every paper, every television station, the internet, it's going viral.
That's nice, I said.
But the accused lawyer didn't shoot anybody. She folded up the paper, looking slightly offended, put it back in her briefcase, and stood to leave.
It's a start toward jury nullification, she said. A damn good start. And you're welcome.
Chapter 28. I'd been in jail for exactly 2 weeks before my mother was able to get in to see me. She came into the visiting room at the Knoxville jail, with the skin on her face looking a bit loose in shadowy circles beneath her eyes. She was on the other side of a piece of plexiglass, and we had to speak through old handheld phone receivers that crackled and cut out completely on occasion. As soon as she saw me, tears fell from both of her eyes. "Don't cry," I said. "This is hard enough."
"You look terrible, Darren. What are they doing to you in here?"
"Nothing I haven't deserved. And you don't look so good yourself."
"What are they doing? Are they beating you?"
"Not so much now," I said. "The news coverage about Jalen Jordan has eased things up a lot."
"Why haven't you called me?"
"Because I only get out of the cell for about a half hour a day, and every time I get out, they tell me the phones aren't working. Besides, it's ridiculously expensive, and we both need to accept that I'm in here for a long time. We need to deal with it. Calling you would only make me miss being free even more than I already do."
"Please call once in a while," she said. "I want to hear your voice."
I nodded and asked the question that had been tormenting me.
"How's Sean?"
She looked down and folded her hands together.
"I don't know," she said. "Katie won't let me see him."
"Miserable bitch," I said. "Small-minded, cheating, geezer-screwing bitch. I can't say it surprises me, though. Do you plan to do anything about it?"
"Of course I'm going to do something about it. Sean needs me now more than ever. Can you imagine what Katie is saying about you? She'll have him thinking you're Hitler reincarnated before it's over."
"He doesn't know who Hitler is, Mom."
"Well, Godzilla reincarnated then, or some kind of evil dragon."
"Do you know the process? You have to file a petition in juvenile court and ask the judge to order Katie to let you see him. You'll have to hire a lawyer."
"I've talked to more lawyers in the past week than I care to remember. They're really sleazy, Darren. Are you like that?"
"I don't know. I hope not. I try not to be sleazy, but sometimes it just sort of comes with the territory."
"I've spoken to a couple of lawyers besides the people I talked to about being able to see Sean. I think I can hire somebody for you."
"Don't even tell me their names," I said. "I have a perfectly good lawyer and she's free. You've met her, right? You've talked to her a couple of times."
"I have. I've met her, and she seems very bright and very capable, but she's so young."
"I was young when I got Uncle Tommy out of prison."
"You had help, though. You had Richie."
"She has help, too, Mom. First of all, she has me. I'm not exactly in my right mind these days, and I realize that, but I still have a lot of experience as a lawyer, and I can help her out if she needs it. There are also older lawyers in her office. I know a couple of them, and they're very good. If she needs help with something, I'm sure all she has to do is ask. And they have their own investigators. I think she'll do a good job. She's already tried 15 cases, and she's been on the job only 3 years. Most lawyers don't try 15 cases in their entire careers. And the last thing I want you doing is spending your life savings on lawyers. Do you know how many miserable scumbags have come into my office over the past 7 years, depending on their mommies to pay their way out of trouble? I'm not going to be one of those guys." We sat there looking at each other for a few minutes, mother and son, barely able to comprehend the situation that faced us. Thinking about what Katie had done made me want to scream, to jump up and start destroying everything around me. But I knew it would result only in my being thrown into the admin cell for a couple of days. And at some level, I'd known Katie would do what she'd done as soon as they led me out of the restaurant in handcuffs. She had seized the high ground now and was lobbing artillery shells on me. She'd blow me to bits if she could. Had the situation been reversed, I like to think I would have put Sean's needs first, and I would have made sure he had contact with his mother. But the situation wasn't reversed. It was what it was, and I had to accept it. Besides, when I thought about it, I realized that I didn't want Sean seeing me confined by the concrete and the steel and the bars and the windows. I didn't want to talk to him through an ancient phone. He wouldn't have understood why I couldn't lift him in my arms and kiss him on the cheek and hug him like I always had. He wouldn't understand why his dad couldn't leave and come home with him. As I thought about him, tears began to well in my eyes and I swallowed hard. Don't show weakness. Don't ever show weakness.
You've lost weight, Mom finally said. Are you eating?
A little more now than I was, I said. We get one hot meal every 3 days. That's either hot dogs and tater tots or fish sticks and tater tots. The rest of the time it's cold bologna sandwiches. The place is so overcrowded, they don't have room in the budget for decent food.
Can I do anything to help?
You can put some money in my commissary account. I need underwear and socks and stamps and pencils and paper. And I can buy a snack every now and then if I want.
Will they let you have a television?
No.
Books?
If you send them to me.
How long can you keep your office open without taking new cases?
Mom